It is too good.
Shut up. I'm not telling you how much it is. Did you go online?
I believe it was a big picture of the whole year.
No, this is way better than I heard it back. That one would cost $50. That's what happens when you have to do all that.
Thought I'd start near the end of what we did before, but overlap it a little bit. General points that for this decision analysis, where do the numbers come from? Part of the point of the analysis is to push you into seeing what numbers you need to make a decision. And the alternatives include thinking, talking to the client or colleagues, professional expertise, and so forth. Probability might be data of past cases, doing some research with mock trials, looking inside your head and seeing what you believe, which may not be very good, but might be better than nothing. And similarly, issues for payoffs, noting that payoffs are not all in money. Some payoffs are in reputation, which might have monetary consequences later, and some are on things like whether people feel good about themselves and the like. Sensitivity analysis, would a small change in your assumptions change the conclusion? And one point that the authors don't make and should is that that may mean that the action doesn't matter very much. That is to say, if you have a case where you say, my conclusion is that their settlement offer is $6 lower than what we can expect at trial, it's true that if you change your assumptions a little bit, you'll conclude that their settlement offer is $6 more than that we can get at trial. But so you lose $12 by or $6 by making the wrong decision, that's not a very big change. So there's a sense in which if the result is very sensitive, that also suggests that which choice you make probably doesn't matter unless it's sensitive to something that's causing a big swing in the results. Now, it might be, if you imagine what you're talking about is we will probably win the case, but there's a 1% chance of a $100 million loss, changing that to 2%. Is a small change in percentages, but a large change in expected costs. So that would be one where you would want to worry about your sensitivity analysis. All right, let me review what we've done. You set up a problem as boxes for choices, circles for chance outcomes, lines joining them, payoffs, plus or minus, and probabilities. I noticed, by the way, looking at how the book did it and how I don't think I ended up doing it last time, that the numbers over each box or circle are all from payoffs to the right of that. So that if you've got a litigation cost here and then a box here, that litigation cost only comes in one step back at the decision that's followed by the litigation cost followed by the outcome. We'll see that in a few minutes. You start at the end, you start at the right-hand side of the diagram, calculate expected returns. Each time you've got a choice between two or more things, and it's clear which one is best, you lop off the others because they don't matter, and just continue right to left until you've got an outcome. So it's a very simple mechanism. We're going to be seeing the same mechanism used in game theory, I think perhaps a little less defensively for reasons we'll see, for what's called subgame perfect equilibrium, which is what happens when you take something like a decision theory diagram, but with two players, and at each step, when somebody has a choice, you lop off the alternative that he wouldn't make. Among the complications that we have to worry about, one of them is that economists and mathematicians usually do stuff in terms of expected return, probability times dollar payoff summed. That's the right answer in some cases, but not in others. Some people have reason to be risk-averse, have reason to regard a $100,000 gain as not as much as twice as good as a $50,000 gain, and then you're going to have to weight numbers differently. Yep.
Can we go over an example of that?
Sure.
Who's the risk-averse?
Well, let me take the very simple example, which will involve many of us, which is insuring your house against fire. If you were risk-neutral, the only reason you insure your house against fire, the only obvious reason, is if you thought the insurance company was stupid. Because the insurance company has to cover its costs. So if there's one chance in 1,000 that your house is going to burn down, and the house is worth $300,000, they've got to be charging you more than $300 a year for that insurance. Otherwise, they'd lose money. But if you're risk neutral, then you say, the cost to me of a one chance in 1,000 $300,000 house burning down each year is $300 a year. I'm paying more than $300 a year to avoid that by the insurance. Isn't that stupid of me? It's only because you're risk averse, because you say, if the house burns down and it isn't insured, losing $300,000 is a lot more than 1,000 times as bad as losing $300 to me. All right, losing $300,000 means I can't afford to send my kid to college or some other important element of yours. So that would be a simple example of risk aversion. And if you think about it in terms of a client, you can imagine a client who has suffered some injury due to someone else's tort, and the settlement offer is $500,000, which your client in his circumstances figures will be enough to live at a modest standard of living for the rest of his life. And the question is, should you accept that, or should you gamble $1.5 million, which you think you might get 50%? 50%, you get nothing. It is very likely that your client would say, I'd rather have $500,000 for sure than 50% chance of nothing and having to try to support myself in my present crippled condition without the money versus 50% chance of $1.5 million. Does that make sense? Now, in a world, in what economists would think of as a world of complete markets, what you would do is to say to your client, that's all right, I've got a better over here who is willing to pay you $650,000 for certain in exchange for his collecting your 50% chance of $1.5 million. All right, that would be a nice market to have if it were possible to sell tort claims, which most, for the most part, under our legal system, it isn't. And that issue is one which I've actually discussed in a chapter in a different book, in one of my books. But as long as you can't easily transfer risk like that, now your client may well prefer to have a certainty of a smaller sum rather than a risk of a larger, even if on average it comes out higher. On the other hand, if your client is Apple or Microsoft or Google, and you're talking about trivial sums like $1 million or $2 million, they're going to be risk neutral, because as far as they're concerned, that's a very small part of their total revenue for the year or their total wealth, and therefore they don't really value the millionth dollar any less than the first dollar. That makes sense? So it's going to depend a good deal on who your client, what kind of a person your client is. And you can imagine a client who is a gambler. You can imagine a client who says, yeah, do the $1.5 million after all. If we got the $500,000, you know what I'd do with it. I'd go to Las Vegas and see if I could turn it into $1.5 million. And you're giving me better odds than Vegas will. All right, so you could imagine a customer like that, but it's probably not too likely. So you have to work out the structure of the problem with help from the client and other people to estimate the probabilities and the payoffs. So let's start with... Actually, I did this one already, right? Yeah, we did QuickBot. Did we do this one?
No.
No, we didn't. I'm sorry. Keeping track of which was review and which was... All right, so your client... This was the one of the handouts, and so you've all done it, right? Get Rich Investors has been sued by Quincy QuickBuck, who alleges that his broker at Get Rich misled him into purchasing risky investments. QuickBuck lost $100,000, but is willing to accept a mere $25,000 as the settlement compensation. And you think that litigation costs to be about $30,000, and that QuickBuck has a 10% chance of success and would collect $100,000. But it would also result in damaging the reputation of Get Rich, and they see that reputational loss from losing that suit as $200,000. So what should they do? Should they accept the offer or not?
Accept the offer.
Because?
The cost of accepting the offer is $25,000, and the expected cost of declining is... I wasn't sure, do you include the... I was wondering, do the if they win, does the other side have to pay their litigation costs?
No. Okay. That's what's called the British rule, and it's not the usual rule in the U.S., although there are cases where
so then the expected cost would be $60,000.
would be
60,000.
Would be 30,000 litigation costs plus 300,000 times 10% is 30,000. Everybody agree with that result? And if you diagram it out, what do you see? You see accept, you lose 25,000, reject, you pay 30,000 here, and then 10% of 300,000. Sorry, I'm pointing at my screen, which doesn't do much good to you, but you can see that. And then you can see that your 10% of 300,000 is equal to 30,000. I think last time I was including things like the litigation cost in that, but I checked, and the book's way of diagramming it is that they're only showing under the circle everything to the right of the circle. So then you've got to add up in your head the next time and say 30,000 minus 30,000 minus another 30,000 is minus 60,000. That's worse than minus 25,000. So we cut off that branch, and minus 25,000 is our net loss. Everybody happy with that result? Yes? No? Got the same result. Are you happy with it if we go outside the textbook? All right. If it's a real case, it doesn't come out with a handout giving either the alternatives or the choices and the probabilities. So your first step is to think about the structure of the problem before you put numbers to it. Are there either costs or alternatives that you haven't considered so far and perhaps should? Any cost that seems to that might have been left out that might change your conclusions? Yep. There is a double reputational cost if you settle. Now, it's true that you can presumably agree that the settlement, the terms of the settlement, will be kept quiet, but the fact that there was a settlement won't be kept quiet. So therefore, if you're engaged in giving advice to people who make, in effect, gambles on the stock market, some of them are going to lose money. And anybody who loses $100,000, especially if he knows the lawyer who this guy hired, is going to say, look, we know how these people got, they're pushovers. I'm going to sue him for $25,000, maybe $30,000 this time. In fact, if they saw your decision theory thing, they'll sue you for $55,000. All right? Make sense? So that's one issue that you might want to think about. Are there any others that I should say a second one, which they're really, in effect, admitting. And that is, they're looking at the reputational cost of losing the case, but they're not looking at the difference between the reputational cost of settling and of winning the case. All right? That one effect of settling is to encourage other people to sue you. But another effect of settling is that a customer is going to say, I don't know if I should pay these guys for their advice. Look, they got sued by one of their clients, and did they refuse to pay? No, they paid them off. We don't know how much. They kept it secret, but probably a fair amount of money. So you might have reputational losses from settling as well as reputational losses from
settling. Yes, as well. You can say, well, these guys, when they admit that they're wrong, they're more reasonable, they'll pay you. You know, it's hard to understand how it is. And also, if you fight and you win, they could chill further cases.
That is, you may want to say that if some of your customers suspect that the suit is justified, you're right. Then they might say the fact that you were willing to settle and save everybody's lawyer fees shows you're reasonable people. We're willing. And
you're safe and you're good to work with.
Whereas alternatively, if you sue, you're a hard ass. But I think the problem with that, it seems to me, is the particular industry involved. Because given, if there's any reason to think that your investment advisor is swindling you,
yeah,
you're going to look for another investment advisor, I would think.
And then there's also the basic point
is that yes, these choice problems are good for seeing the structure of how you do the calculation, but you really have to, in any real world case, work out for yourself what the real alternatives are. Can you think of any other alternatives?
Well, I was thinking at a certain point, isn't there no way to avoid getting nickel and dimed by small suits? Like, as long as the value is low enough, so instead of 25, then you're asking for 10. Five. And as long as it continues to be low, and you are often at risk for being cautious, then is there no way to avoid that?
It's an interesting question.
But you find it at a certain point. If, as long as the value is low enough, you're cutting off your rose spider base, right? You're really fighting too much.
Well, it isn't entirely clear because, look, yeah.
Well, there's also the principle that if it's an entirely frivolous lawsuit, you can file Rule 11 sanctions.
Right. So another alternative you might want to think in your structure is that if you win, you may be able to, in effect, countersue them for a frivolous lawsuit. Right? Just for a minor suggestion for reforming our legal system, another course I teach is a seminar in legal systems very different from ours, and one of the systems we look at is classical Athens, the Athens of Pericles and Socrates and those people. In that system, prosecution of what we would think of as crimes was private, by basically any adult male Athenian citizen. If you won the case, the prosecutor collected a sizable chunk of the fine that was the punishment. If you failed to get at least 30% of the jury to vote for you, the prosecutor was fined. So that's an interesting equivalent, as it were, in a sort of semi-criminal, semi-tort system of what you're describing. So that's a possibility. Can you think of any other possibilities that you might want to look into? Might you want to look, for example, at the history of the plaintiff? Suppose it turns out that this is the 17th such suit that the plaintiff with the same attorney has made against 17 different investment advisors. That might both be a reason to think it would be dangerous to give in, but also it might be useful. Is that? I assume that's... You can introduce that. Court, or can you? You're the lawyers. I'm not. Can I introduce...
Relevant evidence to previous actions, like untrustworthy, like evidence.
Now, another thing you could do, you might think about, going back to reputational issues, is commitment strategies. Suppose what you do is to make a big press release public campaign out of the fact that you don't pay off people who are trying to engage in frivolous, extortionate lawsuits. And the reason you do that is to persuade the next person who might try this that you're in fact going to insist on going to court. It's going to cost him $30,000. And given, if you can get the numbers right at least, it's not going to pay him. So that would be a possibility. I was actually thinking about a case, something that I ran into a while ago and was then checking on the web, which was that there was a story which for a while was all over audiophile websites about a big company that makes audio cables that apparently has a general practice of suing everybody they have any excuse to sue for things like, the company is Monster Cable Company, and they apparently actually sued a golf course, I think maybe one of these miniature golf courses, for calling themselves the Monster Golf Course on the claim that was a trademark infringement. And somebody making another cable who they sued wrote them this entertaining and persuasive response in the course of which he pointed out that he, the president of the company they were suing, was himself an attorney with considerable experience in IP law, and listing all the things they ought to provide if they wanted to support their entirely frivolous claims. And he then published this. He made this available so that everybody on the internet who was interested in audio cables and didn't like this company was saying, aha, what idiots they are to have, you know, sued somebody who's going to really get them. And you can see how, in some circumstances, strategies like that might be ways of committing yourself so that the other person will back down. All right? Something that we'll discuss more in the context of game theory, but it's relevant in some of these. Right, here's the next one that we had. As evidence of my innocence of popular culture, I did not realize until a student, I think last year, pointed out to me why the name was Jordy Michaels. But I gather this is similar to the name of a famous athlete. All right. So we have three possibilities for Jordy Michaels' condition next year. One is he will be healthy, 50% chance, and he really likes playing and having all of the fans pursue him. And in that case, he would play for you even if you weren't paying him anything. Second, he will be in poor condition such that playing will be painful, but he can still do it. And in that case, he will do it, but only if he gets $2 million at least more by playing than by not playing. And the third is he will be unable to play. Okay. So is the Unicorns a play on the name of any real team? Anybody know? All right, just curious. What?
Is
No?
The Wizards?
The Wizards? Is there a team called the Wizards? Anyway. So one possible offer is pay him $6 million whether or not he plays. All right? If you do that, what will happen if his health is fine? His health is fine. What will he do if you say he's getting... What? He'll play, of course. And you get $20 million and you pay $6 million, so you're $14 million to the good. What will happen in that situation if his health is, if his condition is not so good? Second alternative. Will he? Why will he play?
He's getting paid more than the $6 million, right? Or the $2 million that he wants.
But the $2 million, he gets the $6 million whether or not he plays.
Oh, so you're right. I was thinking that...
Very common mistake, but the relevant question is not how much he's getting paid. He's not doing it for gratitude. The relevant question is how much he gets paid for playing instead of not playing. And since the first offer says he gets paid whether or not he plays, he's getting zero for playing. He's getting $6 million for existing, for breathing. So he won't play in that case. And in the third case, he can't play.
But in that other case, if you offer him $2 million.
But that's
not.
No, the hypothetical is just you're paying him $6 million whether or not he plays.
But is that an option?
Once we've gone through the problem as stated, we can then think about whether there are better alternatives. But the problem as stated is only considering two contracts, and one of them is a $6 million independent. It's not clear what they're getting for their $6 million. It sounds like they should have offered him 6 cents instead. From the problem as stated, but. And the other one is that they pay him $10 million, but only conditional on his playing. All right? So if they pay him $10 million conditional on his playing, what happens if his health is good? Obviously, right? What?
He gets $10 million.
He plays, he gets $10 million, they get $20 million, they're $10 million better off. Now what happens if he's not feeling so good? He still plays because he's getting $10 million for playing and zero for not playing. And again, they get a $10 million gain. And if his health is really bad, he doesn't get $10 million, he doesn't play. So the team doesn't get any money, but at least they don't have to pay him anything. All right? So you want to do this in your head, or have you diagrammed it? Let's try diagramming it. So I just summed up the options on the top. He's either fine, or he hurts, or he can't play. One of the options is $6 million whether or not he plays, and the other is $10 million only if he plays. So here is the set of alternatives. That's the diagram. So if we take the top one, actually, can you see the? You can see the cursor, so I can point at things by manipulating stuff on this screen. All right, so if we take the top one, $20 million with a 50% chance is worth how much? $10 million. $0 with a 25% chance is worth how much? Zero. $0 with a 25% chance is still worth zero. All right. So his total expected return on that one is $10 million at that stage when you get to this circle. All right. How about minus $10 million? Because this one they're paying if he plays, plus $20 million with a 0.5 chance is worth how much? $5 million is what I get to. And minus 10 plus 20 with a 25% chance is worth how much? 2.5, right. And $0 is still worth zero. Yep.
Yeah, on the $6 million branch on option two, why is he still playing there? Why
no, he isn't playing. The $6 million, the payment was not conditional on his playing.
But he said he'd play as long as he's making $2 million. So he'd make
no, as long as he made $2 million by playing instead of not playing. Let's go back to the previous slide, if I can get this to do it. It's a very common misreading. But if you look at that contract, it explicitly says, pay him $6 million whether or not he plays. All right?
$2 million is just like a delta to the side of the
The $2 million.
These aren't optimized for anything.
This is not a sensible set of contract offers. We'll discuss that afterwards. But given this set of offers, if I say I'm giving you $6 million, and they say, do I have to play? No, I give you $6 million if you play. I give you $6 million if you don't play. Well, my shoulder's hurting. Right?
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah.
I'm not arguing it's a sensible contract. The question, if we make this assumption, if we assume A, that the facts about Jordy are as stated, and B, that he's stupid enough to tell people these facts, then I think it's pretty obvious that they're making the wrong offer.
Right.
We'll get to that. But given the set of alternatives we're given here, he isn't going to play on that branch because on that branch he isn't getting anything for playing, he's just getting it for breathing. Right. So that one is $10 million, this one is $7.5 million. However, in evaluating them, we then have to note that this $10 million, you've got to pay $6 million to buy that $10 million, as it were, so the net result is only $4 million on this branch. People follow that? Whereas the net result is $7.5 million here, and that means that we cut off the upper branch and that we end up with a $7.5 million return, and we make him that offer. Does that make sense so far, given the screwy assumptions? So what do we add for the story? It's easy, given that alternative, you offer the second contract. And implicitly, we've not only solved the team's decision, we've also solved the player's decision. All right? Because the player has got to decide, in each of these cases, do I play or not play? And we've been told what the decision for that is. The decision for that is, if I don't get any more by playing than not playing, then I play if I'm feeling fine and not otherwise. And if I get $6 million more for playing, or $10 million more for playing than not playing, then I play if I'm either feeling fine or feeling so-so, but not if I'm really crippled. All right? Is that clear enough so far? Now the next question first is, given these facts, what would you advise the team to do other than firing the attorney who drafted the first pair of contracts? If we really believe the facts are as stated, what do we do?
$2 million.
Conditional $2 million if he plays, and how much if he doesn't play? Zip. All right? That is, it looks as though on this case, as stated, you don't have to offer him anything to play if he's healthy. So if you just said, we'll offer you $2 million, ideally, what you'd really like to do is to bug his doctor's office. And then if he's healthy, offer him 10 cents. And if he's in moderate pain, offer him $2 million. But assuming you don't have the information, the best you can do is to say $2 million if you play, nothing if you don't play. All right? And that one will result in his playing in either of the first two cases, and you're paying him $2 million instead of $6 million or $10 million, and then you're paying nothing and he's not playing in the third case. Is that argument reasonably clear? But let's think about it from Jordy's standpoint for a moment, just to be a little more realistic and again introduce stuff. Jordy may not be entirely happy with being told that it's zero if you don't play and only $2 million if you play. I mean, he's a star player, he's worth more than $2 million. So what are a number of the things he might consider?
Well, he can ask for 75% of $20 million.
One of the things he could do is to say, yeah, I like playing and it'll really hurt me to take a year off. It'll hurt you even more to take a year off. So let's get serious now. And even though it's true that if all I was thinking about was play or not play, I'd play just for the fun of it, I think I'm only going to play if you give me $10 million or $15 million or some. Ideally $19,999,999 if he knows it accurately enough. So that's one point, is that we are assuming his behavior is non-strategic, as it were. Assuming he just does what achieves his immediate objectives and that he doesn't have the option of insisting on holding out. Something else he could do is to lie to them. He could say, even if it's perfectly true that he'd play for nothing, and even if that was really their final offer, he'd do it, he doesn't tell them that. He says, I've really been feeling tired, and you know, I've been thinking maybe I should try football instead of baseball. And, you know, I've been talking. You saw me out at lunch at this high-end restaurant with the manager of a football team who's a friend of mine. And, you know, you've heard these rumors have started going around that I've thought about switching sports. So let's not piddle around with this $2 million or $6 million contract. So you can think of a variety of ways in which he could change the alternatives facing the firm in such a way that the firm would make a contract more favorable. And some of those involve changing the information they get, and some of them would involve commitment strategies in which he tells them the truth, but he also says, I'm going to tie my hands, I'm going to make a public announcement to the press saying that if those guys are too cheap to give me the $10 million I'm worth, I'm not playing for them. Now, all of this, of course, ignores the existence of other basketball teams, which... I think it's basketball, whatever it is, which you would expect to complicate things a good deal, but it's a toy case, of course. Comments? Questions? Anybody?
I just have one question.
Yep.
So, back in your example, like the way you drew the tree out,
yes.
Do you have to put the $6 million? You don't give the $6 million, you got it separated.
Yes.
Can you just incorporate that into the final payoffs?
The answer is that when I originally did it, I did. When I originally did it, I had $4 million for this number up here. And then I checked how the book did it, and I wanted to be consistent with the book. And it's clear that what the book is doing is that the number at each juncture, circle or square, is the sum of everything to the right of that. So that the way they're thinking is saying, if you get to this circle, you get $10 million. And $6 million in this case is the price of getting to the circle.
So you'd rather us do it this way?
I think so. It doesn't really matter. I mean... It's logically it's the same, but it's probably worth following a consistent pattern, and the book looks a little more confusing if you didn't do it. So yeah, I actually corrected that from the way I'd originally drawn these figures. Incidentally, I don't know about you, but I think it's quite snazzy the way PowerPoint lets me make things appear as I go through it. It may just be because I'm from an earlier generation where I'm used to thinking of slides as static. And I have spared you the, as you may know, there's this whole palette of, I could give you a sunset in the background or God knows what else in the background of the slides, most of which strike me as distracting. But I do think that being able to, and all of these just appear, I'm not having them fly in or fade in or come in bits and pieces, which might be fun once in a while, but I do think that just the ability to animate slides in a low-tech kind of way is rather nice. So, anyway, let's keep going. Where were we? Let's think a bit more about a question they touch on rather briefly and I think not entirely satisfactorily about the value of information. And the question is, when should you pay to acquire information? And the sort of short answer is when the information is worth more than it costs. And then the question is, what is information worth? And I think the way of thinking about the problem is to say, if I don't have this information, what will I do? So if you think about the Jordy Michaels case, suppose that in fact the doctor has already examined him and knows which of these states he's going to be in. So you could say, without that information, we do the calculation we've just done, and we work out whatever it was, $7.5 million, I think, is how much we make out of it. All right, and I then say, well, all right, it just happens that we know this nurse at the doctor's office. And she'd sort of like to retire from being a nurse. She likes Caribbean islands and fast cars and stuff like that. And so maybe if we were willing to slip a small sum of money to her, she'd tell us what the doctor had found out. And then the question becomes, if we knew which of these three outcomes had occurred, what would we do? Well, if we knew that he was healthy, what would we do? In fact, let's assume that the team is not stupid. So the team's original plan is not the plan we diagrammed, it's the plan we discussed afterwards. So the original plan is offering $2 million conditional on his playing. All right? And they say, what's the expected return of that? The expected return of that is a three-quarters chance that he plays, and a three-quarters chance that we pay him $2 million. If he plays and we pay him $2 million, we're getting a net of $18 million. Three-quarters of $18 million is $13.5 million. So that's our expected return on that strategy. All right? Clear enough so far? And the question is, how much should we offer the nurse that we have to buy the doctor's information? And if we buy the information, there, let's work through the odds.
Well, should it be worth the expectation of the cost of that brand?
Let's run through it. Without the information, we make 0.75 times 18 million. Everybody happy with that result? Right? 3/4 of the chance he plays, either in pain or not in pain, we pay him 2 million, we get 20 million, 18 million times 3/4. With the information, we don't yet know what the information is going to be. So what is it? There's a 0.5 chance that the nurse will say, oh, he's perfectly healthy. Tried to take me out after the exam. And if she tells us that, what do we do?
Then you give him 10 cents.
We offer essentially nothing. We say, you know, we'll make you the star of the show. We aren't going to pay you anything, really. How much money do you make on that in that situation? What's the total amount? We're comparing expected returns to the two strategies. What is your expected return in that situation?
You're going to get all of it.
Which is?
20.
Right. So 0.5 chance that we make 20 million minus, of course, the cost of the information, whatever that is, but we're going to figure out what it's worth and then see what that is. 20 million, so that equals 10 million dollars on that possibility. 18 million here. That was 13.5. Correctly. So we have a 0.25 chance that she'll say, well, he was in pain, but he said he would still play. Or the doctor said he could still play. In that case, what are we going to do? We offer 2 million conditional as playing, all right? So in that case, we have 18 million. Times 0.25. So 18 million times 0.25 is 4,500,000. And there's a 0.25 chance that the answer will be, sorry, he's finished. In that case, how much do we give him? How much do we get? Zip. So that's zero. So the total return, if we get the information, is 14.5. Expected return. And the expected return if we don't have the information is 13.5. All right, yeah?
But what I suggest is that don't you just figure how much money you save? Right? Like, so instead of doing this, you say, well, if we know that he's healthy, we're saving $2 million. And there's only 50% chance that $2 million is going to be spent. So half of that is going to be a million, which would be the difference between the 13 and the 14.
You are reminding me of my high school chemistry class, where every time the teacher had a standardized way of doing every problem. And each time there was a problem, you would run through the standardized way. And then he said, anybody do it a different way? And I'd raise my hand, because I invented a different way of doing the problem. And they were equivalent, of course. They're all equivalent to give the same answer. Similarly, you're perfectly right. A different way, and possibly a quicker way, would be to say the information only matters if it affects what we do. It doesn't affect what happens here, because the 2 million is going to be conditionalized playing, so we'll end up playing, paying him nothing, hearing whatever we offer. It doesn't affect it here, because we'd offer 2 million. It only means that we can save 2 million in 0.5 chance, and that saves us $1 million. That's a perfectly legitimate way of doing it. The only argument against it, which is basically the argument against what I was doing in chemistry class, is that while it's fun to invent the shortest way of solving each problem, you are probably more likely with lots of problems to consistently not make mistakes if you've got a sort of a simple mechanical filament length. They're both perfectly legitimate, and mine is more boring than yours. So anyway, so if you look at this, you can see that we have a $1 million gain from the information. All
right? And that $1 million gain from the information means that we should be willing to pay the nurse up to $1 million, assuming that this is a full account of the story. We might want to take account of the possibility that the nurse is lying to us, or the possibility that we'll get caught bribing the nurse and get into difficulties of that sort. You can think of a variety of further possible stories. You might even want to consider the possibility that that Geordie has bribed the nurse or influenced the nurse in some other way, and that she's going to tell us whatever maximizes his income. So she's going to tell us, you know, he's not only he's in pain, he's in so much pain that unless you pay him at least $10 billion, he's not going to play. All right, so you have to worry about other things. But nonetheless, I think this gives us a nice, simple illustration of the process of estimating the value of information. And how you do it is really up to you. So note, if you look at sort of the mechanical version that I'm running through here, you say, without the information, what would we do? We would offer him $2 million conditional on playing. What's the return from that? With the information, what we would do, and that's more complicated because we now have three different alternatives according to what the information is. So our probabilistic calculation, our expected value, includes the probabilities of those of different kind of information coming in, and then the return with what each information is. And you could imagine a case where once you have the information, there are still some random events you don't know about, so you could have then two layers of probabilistic calculation instead of one. All right, so far. Let's take another case, and one which is maybe more relevant to most of us, and that's the case where you're buying a used car. And we're going to assume that the car has a 50% chance of being a cream puff, meaning for those of you who are not native speakers of American slang, a used car in really good condition, and a 50% chance of being a lemon, meaning to the same hypothetical audience, a car that is going to spend a lot of its time in the repair shop. And we will suppose that a lemon is still worth $6,000 to you, a cream puff is worth $10,000, and the car is up for $7,000. And one alternative is to just buy the car. If you buy the car, what's your expected gain from buying the car? That is a 50% chance of 10,000, 50% chance of 6,000, that's like a 50% chance of 16,000, which is 8,000. All right? Car costs 7,000, so you should go ahead and buy the car, right? Except that you've got another alternative. You know this very expensive but very good mechanic, and he can tell you with certainty whether it's a cream puff or a lemon. Let me click this. The expected gain is $1,000. Unfortunately, he charges $1,000 for this service. So, if it's a cream puff, what are you going to do? You're going to buy it, and what's your gain from buying the car? It's a $10,000 car, you're buying it for $7,000. What's the gain? $3,000, obviously. All right? How about if it's a lemon, what are you going to do? Not going to buy it. It's a $6,000 car for $7,000. Don't buy it, zero. So what's the expected return? You have a 50% chance of $3,000, 50% chance of zero. So what is your expected return now? $1,500. Is it worth $1,000 for the mechanic? It is? I haven't had the price of the mechanic in yet. You get an expected gain of $1,000 without the mechanic, $1,500 with, but you've still got to pay $1,000 to the mechanic. So if the mechanic is charging $1,000, you should turn down his offer. Now, if the mechanic is charging $100, now after paying for the mechanic, it's $1,400 instead of $1,000, and now you do it. So what that calculation will tell you is that your super mechanic is worth up to $500, but not more than that. All right. So that's, again, a nice illustration. And you can see that the smaller the difference between a cream puff and a lemon, the more sensitive your decision is going to be to the price of the mechanic, but also the less it's going to matter which one you do. I should say one reason I was going through the meaning of lemon and cream puff is that there is a famous economics article called The Market for Lemons, which is about lemons in this sense. It's about the problem
of asymmetric information where the seller knows if his car is a cream puff or a lemon and the buyer doesn't. And apparently the author of that article has occasionally gotten correspondence from people who assumed that he was an agricultural economist talking about the market for lemons. All right, here is another one. This one, I should say, is provided by the authors of our textbook and the extra stuff that they gave me, a whole CD full of which I'll only burden you with a little bit of it. And this one is hiring an expert where you are the represent the plaintiff in personal injury. And the dispute is over damages, and your expert thinks the losses, the plaintiff's losses are $1 million, and the defendant's expert thinks it's only $500,000. It's an odd coincidence how it just happens that your expert gets a larger number than theirs. Coincidence you expect to be repeated in the future. And you suspect from past experience the jury in that situation will split the difference, and you'll get about $750,000. And the question is, should you hire a second expert? Second expert is going to cost you $50,000. You think you can find an expert who is skillful enough to get the same result as your previous expert, and you think that the result of that will be an award of about $900,000 with two experts testifying for one side and one expert for the other. There is, however, a fly in the ointment, and that is that you're not the only one who can hire a second expert, and you suspect that the other attorney will have gone through the same set of calculations and that the result will get us back to back to 750 if you both hire it, and if they hire a second one and you don't, then the result will be 600,000. So the first question is, should you hire the expert? I will note that the problem does not give any probabilities, although it does sort of imply that you've got a probability about one for the different jury verdicts. So let's assume for the moment that you have no idea whether the other side is going to hire another expert or not. All right. It's a mystery to you. If you're sure they won't hire another expert, should you hire an expert or not? Yes. Because hiring an expert will increase your return by how much? From 750 to 900 is 150. By 150,000, the expert costs you 50,000, make 100,000 gain. Suppose they're going to hire an expert, what should you do? If they hire an expert and you don't, the return is 600,000. If they hire an expert and you do, it's 750. So what should you do? Hire an expert, right? Cost you 50,000, get an extra 150,000, make 100,000. So you don't need probabilities for that one. Which is a useful thing to realize, all right? If you think about many of these cases, there are some things which nothing depends on. And in this case, whether they hire an expert or not doesn't determine what you should do. Either way, you want to hire an expert. All right? What advice should you give to your client? And do you have any other ideas occur to you? That's one possibility, and I do not know how credulous juries are. I do not know if at some point as the number of experts mounts up and the jury observes that by some odd coincidence, the plaintiff just happens to have hired experts who give high numbers and the defendant just happens to have hired experts who give low numbers, whether the jurors will correctly conclude that all this shows is how much money each side is willing to spend on experts. So one possibility is to hire even more experts. Now, of course, the other side might make the same calculation. Any other possibilities occur to you?
Well, if you persuaded them not to hire an expert.
The other possibility is you go over, you have lunch with the other side's attorney, and you say, look, we've been thinking of hiring an expert. And I bet you've been thinking about hiring an expert. And you know what? If both of us hire an expert, we'll be back exactly where we are now, except we'll be $100,000 poorer. Do you think we could do something about that situation? And assuming that each of you trusts the other one. Is there any way of making a binding commitment, a legally binding commitment, not to hire, not to bring an additional? That's what you want is to sign a contract with the other guy saying, "I won't hire another expert if you don't." Is there any way you can actually do that?
That might actually be like a malpractice or something.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. But what you do instead is we assume that you're practicing in the same city, you're going to meet with each other again, you both have a reputation, you don't want to be regarded as somebody who breaks his word. So you say to the other guy, look, I'll promise not to hire another expert if you'll hire, promise not to hire another expert. And if that goes through, you get the same result, only your $100,000 between you to the good. All right. So that's another case where, which I think in this case the authors were hitting at when they put that final any other ideas, where the diagram is misleading because it leaves out important alternatives. But of course that by itself is informative in a sense. You say we do the diagram, it gives us a result, I don't believe this result, what's wrong? What should be put into the diagram? Yes.
How would you alter that sort of situation if, for instance, your expert isn't as qualified as the second expert they're bringing? I mean, how would the numbers change in that?
When you say isn't as expert, you mean isn't as convincing to the jury?
Isn't as convincing, right. I mean, his credentials aren't as good. Let's say the other guy is from Yale, this guy's only from Cornell, or whatever. And the jury could be the guy from Yale more than this your second expert.
Then you would presumably have to put in a different set of numbers. You would have to say, what do I know in my trial experience about how juries react to experts with different qualifications? And you would then say, all right, if we with the two experts you originally have, I'm not going to get 750, I'm going to get 700,000 because theirs is more credible. And one of the other questions you might want to ask is, what expert should I hire next time? Because guys from Yale are more expensive than guys from Cornell. And in fact, in principle, you could try to make an estimate of what's the value to me of a Yale degree. You can say, all right, if the guy from Yale costs no more than $25,000 more, I should get him. If he costs more than that, I'll be happy with Cornell. And so forth. I'm not an attorney. I haven't done any of this stuff. But presumably, if you were really an attorney regularly practicing in this area, you would have in your head, if not on paper, a sort of a price table, a price and value table that said, look, and it wouldn't just be by where they were graduated from, but by the particular experts. This guy, boy, is he convincing. Right? I wouldn't believe him myself, because I've listened to him in too many trials, but I know what he does to juries. Whereas this guy, he's competent, he's honest, and he's a cold fish, and the juries don't believe him. All right, you could imagine, and I suspect, though I suspect that part of what you were being paid for as a plaintiff's attorney is that kind of expert knowledge that you would need in order to do it. I have testified as an expert witness, I suppose, only once in my life. And interesting experience. The funny part of that experience was that I was present, this was an economics analysis of a problem, and that I was present when they deposed the other side's expert witness, who was also an economist. And the theory of the process was that we weren't supposed to talk to each other, that I could talk to our attorneys, he could talk to their attorneys, and I guess he could talk to our attorneys too. And it very rapidly became a conversation between us. Because we spoke the same language. When it was over, we discussed the possibility of jointly writing an article on the subject we were working on. We never did it, never wrote the article as it happened. But we pretty much agreed. It was clear what the arguments were on both sides, and much clearer to us than to them. And that, I thought, was quite an entertaining experience. But I suppose that may also explain why I haven't had lots of jobs as expert witness. That I regarded it too much as a source of entertainment and too little as a source of income. All right, let's think a little bit, since I really don't think the chapter has 2 days' worth of stuff in it, about applying these ideas to some of the decisions you might someday want to make. So suppose you are choosing a law school. Go back a few years, and you're out of college. Maybe you've done some other things for a few years. And first question is, who do you apply to? Let's go back a step. The first question is, what are you going to try to apply to? So you haven't taken the LSATs yet, let us suppose. Could even go further. Maybe you haven't even graduated from college yet. At the point when you're finished, you finish your sophomore year in college, and you're thinking about what law school you want to go to, what are the sets of choices you might want to diagram at that stage? They're thinking of applying at the moment to either Chicago, Santa Clara, or what's a school a couple of steps down from Santa Clara? Golden Gate? Fine, Golden Gate. I don't know if it's true. Maybe it's slanderous, but I'll accept your claim. And you say to yourself, I've looked at the evidence, and Golden Gate will accept anybody with at least a B average and the appropriate amount of money. Santa Clara is a good deal pickier. You people probably know better than I do how picky they are. And they're going to require somebody who got A's in the following sorts of courses and at least B's in the rest of their courses. And Chicago, they aren't going to even look at you if you ever got more than one B in your last 2 years of college. So what are you going to want to ask yourself about these three colleges other than the information on how hard it is to get in?
What are the easiest courses in Chicago?
I was thinking what you were going to ask about the schools you were going to, but you're certainly some of the questions you would want to ask if you figured that grades were all they were going to look at would be how easily can I get good grades and at what cost? Because you might say, yes, but that's only by learning things I have no use for, whereas if I take a course in German, there are lots of reasons I might want to know German in the future, and that's less likely to get me an A because it's a harder course. But yeah, so at one end of it, you would like to look at decisions you can make that will affect the grade you get and what those decisions cost you. And it could be costing in terms of taking courses you don't want to take. It could also be costing in terms of working very hard when you'd rather have time to go to parties or do whatever else you like doing. But you could think it essentially in terms of, here are my alternatives now, and at various costs and things that matter to me, I can push my GPA up. And what's the other end of that you'd like to ask? The reason to push your GPA up is to get into Santa Clara instead of Golden Gate or Harvard, or sorry, Chicago instead of Santa Clara. So what ought you to ask about those? What? That's half of it. One of the questions is how much do they cost to go, and what's the other question? The value, that's right. How much better off will I be if I go to Harvard than if I go to Chicago, sorry, rather than going to Santa Clara, or to Santa Clara rather than Golden Gate. All right. So if you were thinking about that, there may be some random steps along this line. So when you are deciding whether to go to one of those schools, what's one of the questions you're going to ask? What would you like to know about those schools that might actually be available information?
Job
placement would be one.
Average starting income.
Those would all be useful things if you could get them.
Bar pass rate
would be a big one. All right. Now, that all of those are a little tricky, though, because there are two different reasons why people who graduate from Chicago get more money than people who graduate from Golden Gate. What are the two reasons?
Better students.
They aren't the same people. But you're going to be the same person whichever school you go to. All right. So what you'd really like to do, if you could, is to separate out the effect of the school on income from the effect on income of who goes to the school. And I, in fact, saw a report of a study that did that, not for law schools. It was for colleges, I think. And what they did was to look at students who were accepted by an elite school, some of whom went there and some of whom didn't, and to compare their income thereafter. Because that way, the selection effect that the abler students tend to be accepted by the better schools is eliminated because these people were accepted by Harvard or whatever it was, but turned it down for whatever reason. And their conclusion, for what it's worth, was that going to an elite school gave you a higher income in your first job, but not thereafter. Which I thought was sort of interesting, that basically once you've got a track record from one job, that's going to outweigh the question of whether you went to Harvard or Podunk. But if you just think about the logic of the problem for a moment, you're going to want to look at, first, what's the structure of the choice? The structure of the choice is I first make decisions that will affect my ability to get into different good schools, which are going to include what courses I take, how hard I study for them. Do you study for the LSAT? I have no idea.
Yeah.
Is it supposed to be an aptitude test?
It's not.
It's not, right. So how much work do I want to put into studying for the LSAT? Similarly, the question of That's one side of it. And the other side of it is, among the schools I'm considering, how do they differ in costs? And how do they differ in the benefits I will get from going to them? And it isn't necessarily unambiguous which ones are better. Because if you're really a student who's barely going to be able to get into Chicago, that may be that you're one of the ones who's likely to go to Chicago and then fail the bar. And it might be that you're better off at Golden Gate with other students at about your level, or Santa Clara, or whatever is about your level, because you're going to learn more being taught in a class aimed at you than being taught in a class aimed at the people much smarter than you are who got their A's without having to work. So that would be, I'm just saying there are a whole lot of decisions, but the basic structure of it in terms of what we're doing here is thinking about the choices you make that will get you, thinking about what the payoffs are, trying to estimate the odds, and then going on. I should say one of the reasons I've been thinking about this particular question is that my daughter is in her first year in college. She doesn't like the college she ended up going to. She thinks that two colleges, one of which put her on the waiting list and one of which turned her down, would have been better. And she was therefore very glad to succeed in getting very good grades in her first semester, because that's going to make it easier for her to transfer. So that was a case in which presumably her college might not be happy with, where the incentive to work hard at one college was not to stay in, but to get out. She may change her mind by the time the question comes up. But I thought that was sort of an interesting, again, a decision theory problem, in effect, if you think about it, that occurred in a somewhat odd framework. All right. How about finding a job after law school? All right, so again, let's go back. Are most of you third year or second year?
Second.
All right, so take the second year students. As you are now, if you say, I'm going to have a series of decisions that are going to determine where I am a few years from now, what's the first set? In fact, let's go back maybe to the beginning of this year. What are the decisions that you would have to make that would affect that? What courses to take? And presumably, one of the things that is going to determine that is you're going to look out at future jobs, and you're going to say, well, I observe that the wills and estates business is a hot business at the moment. They're hiring. They pay well. It used to be that transactions were really a hot business, but after the credit crunch, they've all collapsed, and there are six times as many smart people looking for those jobs as there are jobs. You'd have to do whatever kind of analysis you can do. And you would then end up saying, this specialty will do somewhat better than this, somewhat better than this. And you would then decide, that would be one of the things that it would go into deciding what courses to take. What other decisions are you going to make that will determine where you end up in a couple of years from now on?
Where to interview for OCIs?
Where to interview for, what's OCI? On-campus interviews. Yeah, that's pretty cheap. So presumably, don't you interview for everybody you might possibly want to work with or not?
If you consider you have a limited amount of time in the day.
Yeah.
Heavy costs.
Is it a heavy cost? How long does it take? What?
I didn't do it.
I know, you got to put on a suit. First you have to buy a suit and tie.
Yeah.
And then you have to put on the suit and tie. And then you have to cut your hair. And, right.
It's more at the cost of your time and energy, because people I knew who did last semester, and they didn't show up for an entire class because it was the morning and they were doing OCIs, and they were either shuttling back and forth to San Francisco or San Diego and filling out applications and meeting with, you know, partners.
Yeah, so it was complicated.
It's at a cost.
Yeah, it's at a cost. But another decision was only how hard you're going to work in those courses. All right? That you're going to, you know, your time is valuable, and I assume most of you believe that any course in which you're not going to get an A, you probably could raise your grade some if raising your grade was the most important thing, you know, in your life that semester. There are a set of decisions to be made there. Then I assume the next decision is summer jobs, isn't it? Am I right in assuming that the summer job is sort of an apprenticeship, a chance to persuade a law firm that you're really the wonderful person they want to hire, and for them to persuade you similarly? So you'd be making decisions of that sort, and you might have, I don't know this market again, but you might have a case where firm A pays much better or is in a city you want to be in, but firm B, if you can end up with a position with them, is a much better long-term investment. investment. So again, you'd be making these same kind of decisions. And in all of these, in none of these do you really have the numbers to do it right, but in all of these you could think at least of saying, all right, by diagramming it out with a decision diagram, I will have a better idea of what I'm doing than if I simply did it in my head, as it were. It may, among other things, start you thinking about, should I select courses on the basis of where I'll get in. And you might want to go further. You might want to do some research and find out whether any of your professors have contacts at the law firm you want to work at. If so, maybe that's the professor you should be getting an A from. And how about plea bargains? Let's suppose you're doing criminal defense work. How many of you think you know what kind of law you're going to be doing when you become a lawyer? What kind of law are you going to do? Meaning tort litigation. What?
Intellectual property litigation.
Venture
capital law.
We had somebody you knew.
Criminal defense.
Criminal defense. All right, let's take that case. Fine. So you're a criminal defense attorney. We have this dreadful system in which people who are perfectly innocent find it in their interest to plead guilty because of plea bargaining. It's not clear if there are better alternatives or not, but it's in some ways a pretty ugly system. But you've got to do the best you can for your clients. So your client is deciding whether to accept an offered plea bargain. What are the decision is well, there are really, first, what are the alternatives that you could advise him to do? And second, how would you work out the cost, benefits, and probabilities of that?
Well, first thing I'd actually look at is the charge of the crime and what's the maximum you can get and what the DA is really going to go for. What would be allowed. I mean, you'd have to research and see what a jury would give him in that sort of situation.
So the first question is, if he goes to trial, what is the probability of him being convicted, and what would you expect the penalty to be?
Right. Right. And the other one would be, what are they offering on the table? And you have to compare those two and see if he's willing to go. But let's say the punishment would be, now on average, 10 years in prison, whereas what they're giving you is 5 years and probation for, or something like that. Then that might be something you might take into consideration. The other thing I would do is actually, if I took a look at the facts and saw that there was an actual strong case for my client, then I'd probably advise, go ahead and do it, because you don't want this if you're not guilty, first of all. And
you don't want it if you are guilty either, right?
Right. Well, yeah, if you are guilty, you definitely don't want it if you don't spend time there. But, I mean, that's an alternative. But if there's actually no way, and there's...
So you want to start out by saying, what are the odds of his being convicted?
Right.
And you may or may not care whether he's guilty. Putting aside your own moral qualms, there's another reason why you might care whether he's guilty. Because when you say, what are the costs of being convicted? So you say 10 years versus 5 years with 3-year probation. What other costs are there to being convicted?
Well, he might not be able to get a job afterwards. He's never going to lose his reputation. He's always going to have that on his record, all that sort of stuff.
Bunch of stuff like that. Now, it might matter whether he's guilty or not. Suppose he, in fact, is a professional criminal. And as a matter of fact, he's gotten convicted twice before. Well, the reputational effects are negligible. All right? Suppose, on the other hand, that he really committed the crime, but let me take maybe the best case. Suppose he committed the crime and he would like an opportunity to commit the same crime again. It's embezzlement or something. Now he wants the reputation of being honest, even though it's not true. So my point is just that his circumstances are going to affect the value to him or the cost to him of different reputational outcomes.
But doesn't your reputation get hurt regardless? I mean, especially in our system where even if you're found innocent at the end, you're acquitted, your reputation still takes a battering because people have this innate...
But I would have guessed, though I may be wrong, less so than if you plead guilty to a substantial offense. I don't know. I'm actually thinking of stuff I've seen online discussing Michael Milken, who basically plea bargained. As far as I can tell, it's not entirely clear he was guilty of anything, though he might have been. But he was certainly at risk of being found guilty of important things. And my impression is that if he had gone to trial and been acquitted, you wouldn't have had the general perception, of course, he was guilty, which I think is the perception that you now end up with. And Let me think of some other cases that I've heard about. But in any case, but the real point here is that this is this kind of a problem. There's one other issue, which you haven't touched on, and maybe you know enough to know it's not a relevant issue, and that is, will the other side keep their word? Because my understanding is that there are no enforceable contracts here. He can plead guilty to an offense, and they could choose to still prosecute him for a harder offense. Or he could plead guilty after they had implied to you that they let him off with 5 years and 3 years of probation, and then they could try to throw the book at him for what he pleaded guilty for.
They have to actually sign a document that says this is what's going to be a plea bargain.
Do they?
Yeah.
In California?
Because
the judge, I can't.
Yeah, they have to submit to the judge, and the judge can not accept it.
And all of that has to be done before he pleads guilty?
I believe he can plead guilty at first. I mean, it's just a preliminary. And even throughout the trial, they have an opportunity to come to a plea agreement of some sort before the final verdict. So there is plenty of opportunity for them to reach some sort of agreement.
But the question, because I guess that I was mistaken, I had thought that all of these had to be gentlemen's agreements because the prosecutor couldn't bind himself to a...
I think the concern is more on towards the defendant's reactions. I mean, the prosecutor has no reason to go back on his word. I mean, usually not. He's offering the plea. So it's better for the prosecutor to have something written down and then submit to the judge because the defendant is more likely to change his mind than the prosecutor.
Well, but the defendant, once the defendant has pled guilty, he doesn't have the opportunity to change his mind, does he?
You can change your guilty plea. I haven't learned about it yet, but there's some sort of procedure where you can actually change it in mid-process.
Right, because I could imagine at least a prosecutor who says, look, I'm going to look better the stiffer the sentence is.
Right.
And therefore I'll get him to plead guilty to the lesser offense and then press for a very heavy punishment for the lesser offense. And then when people say, look, you let this guy off, I say, yeah, let him off for 15 years in jail. Now, I don't know if that really happens or not. But that does depend on whether you've got an enforceable contract, which is an interesting question. I don't know. All right. So I think that gets us through what I had for this time. We're going to go on to game theory, which I think is rather more fun than this stuff, next time. And if all went well, this lecture will go on.